thousands of them.
Tens of thousands, Sophie corrected him. She turned to look at Flamel. What are they?
The Morrigan's children, he said enigmatically.
Trouble, Scatty added. Big trouble.
Then, as if driven by a single command, the huge flock of birds moved away from the island and headed across the bay, directly toward the bridge. Josh hit his window button, and the tinted glass hummed down. The noise of the birds was audible now, a raucous cawing, almost like high-pitched laughter. Traffic was slowing, some people even stopping to get out of their cars to take photographs with digital cameras and cell phones. Nicholas Flamel leaned forward and placed his left hand on Josh's shoulder.
You should drive, he said seriously. Do not stop. Whatever happens, even if you hit something, just drive as fast as you can. Get us off this bridge.
There was something in Flamel's unnaturally controlled voice that frightened Sophie even more than if he had shouted. She glanced sidelong at Scatty, but the young woman was rummaging through her backpack. The warrior pulled out a short bow and a handful of arrows and placed them on the seat beside her.
Roll up your window, Josh, she said calmly. We don't want anything getting in. We're in trouble, aren't we? Sophie whispered, looking at the alchemist.
Only if the crows catch us, Flamel said with a tight smile.
Could I borrow your cell phone?
Sophie pulled her cell out of her pocket and flipped it open.
Aren't you going to work some magic? She asked hopefully.
No, I'm going to make a call. Let's hope we don't get an answering service.
Chapter 11. Security gates opened, and Dee's black limousine swerved into the driveway, the golem chauffeur expertly maneuvering the car through barred gates into an underground parking garage. Perronel Flamel lurched sideways and fell against the sodden golem sitting on her right-hand side. Its body squelched with the blow, and spatters of foul-smelling mud squirted everywhere. Dr. John Dee, sitting directly opposite, grimaced in disgust and scooted as far away from the creature as he could. He was on his cell phone, talking urgently in a language that had not been used on Earth in more than 3,000 years. A drop of golem mud splashed onto Perronel's right hand. The sticky liquid ran across her flesh and erased the curling symbol Dee had drawn on her skin. The binding spell was partially broken. Perronel Flamel dipped her head slightly. This was her chance. To properly channel her auric powers, she really needed both hands, and, unfortunately, the ward Dee had drawn on her forehead prevented her from speaking. Still. Perronel Delamere had always been interested in magic, even before she met the poor bookseller who later became her husband. She was the seventh daughter of a seventh daughter, and in the tiny village of Quimper, in the northwest corner of France, where she had grown up, she was considered special. Her touch could heal, not only humans, but animals too. She could talk to the shades of the dead, and she could sometimes see a little of the future. But growing up in an age when such skills were regarded with deep suspicion, she had learned to keep her abilities to herself. When she first moved to Paris, she saw how the fortune tellers working in the markets that backed onto the great Notre Dame Cathedral made a good and easy living. Adopting the name Chat Noir, Black Cat, because of her jet black hair, she set herself up in a little booth in sight of the cathedral. Within a matter of weeks, she built a reputation for being genuinely talented. Her clients changed. No longer were they just the tradespeople and stallholders. Now they were also drawn from the merchants and even the nobility. Close to where she had her little covered stall sat the scriveners and copiers, men who made their living writing letters for those who could neither read nor write. Some of them, like the slender, dark-haired man with startling pale eyes, occasionally sold books from their tables. And from the first moment she saw that man, Perronel Delamere knew that she would marry him and that they would live a long and happy life together. She just never realized quite how long. They were married less than 6 months after they first met. They'd been together now for over 600 years. Like most educated men of his time, Nicholas Flamel was fascinated with alchemy, a combination of science and magic. His interest was sparked because he was occasionally offered alchemical books or charts for sale, or asked to copy some of the rarer works. Unlike many other women of her time, Perronel could read and knew several languages. Her Greek was better than her husband's, and he would often ask her to read to him. Perronel quickly became familiar with the ancient systems of magic and began to practice in small ways, developing her skills, concentrating on how to channel and focus the energy of her aura. By the time the Codex came into their possession, Perronel was a sorceress, though she had little patience for the mathematics and calculations of alchemy. However, it was Perronel who recognized that the book written in the strange, ever-changing language was not just a history of the world that had never been, but a collection of lore, of science, of spells and incantations. She had been poring over the pages one bitter winter's night, watching the words crawl on the page, when the letters formed and reformed, and for a heartbeat she had seen the initial formula for the Philosopher's Stone, and realized instantly that here was the secret to life eternal. The couple spent the next 20 years traveling to every country in Europe, heading east into the land of the Rus, south to North Africa, even into Araby, in an attempt to decipher and translate the curious manuscript. They came into contact with magicians and sorcerers of many lands and studied many different types of magic. Nicholas was only vaguely interested in magic. He was more interested in the science of alchemy. The Codex and other books like it hinted that there were very precise formulas for creating gold out of stone and diamonds out of coal. Perronel, on the other hand, learned as much as she could about all the magical arts, but it had been a long time since she had seriously practiced them. Now, trapped in the limo, she recalled a trick she had learned from Estrega, a witch, in the mountains of Sicily. It was designed for dealing with knights in armor, but with a little adjustment. Closing her eyes and concentrating, Perronel rubbed her little finger in a circle against the car seat. Dee was absorbed in his phone call and didn't see the tiny ice-white spark that snapped from her fingertip into the fine-grained leather. The spark ran through the leather and coiled around the springs beneath. It shot, fizzing and hissing, along the springs and into the metal body of the car. It curled into the engine, buzzing over the cylinders, circled the wheels, spitting and snapping. A hubcap popped off and bounced away, and then, abruptly, the car's electrics went haywire. The windows started opening and closing of their own accord. The sunroof hummed open, then slammed shut. The wipers scraped across the dry windshield, then beat so fast they snapped off. The horn began to sound out an irregular beat. Interior lights flickered on and off. The small TV unit in the left-hand wall popped on and cycled dizzyingly through all its channels. The air tasted metallic. Tendrils of static electricity now danced around the interior of the car. Dee flung his cell phone away, nursing suddenly numb fingers. The phone hit the carpeted floor and exploded into shards of melted plastic and hot metal.
"You,"
Dee began, turning to Perronel, but the car lurched to a halt, completely dead. Flames leapt from the engine, filling the back of the car with noxious fumes. Dee pushed the door, but the electric locks had engaged. With a savage howl, he closed his hand into a fist and allowed his rage to boil through him. The stench of smoke, burning plastic and melting rubber, was abruptly concealed beneath the stink of sulfur, and his hand took on the appearance of a golden metal glove. Dee punched straight through the door, practically ripping it off its hinges, and flung himself out onto the cement floor. He was standing in the underground car park of Enoch Enterprises, the huge entertainment company he owned and ran in San Francisco. He scrambled back as his $150,000 custom-made car was quickly consumed by fire. Intense heat fused the front of the car into irregular clumps of metal, while the windshield flowed like candle wax. The golem driver was still sitting at the wheel, unaffected by the intense heat, which did nothing but bake its skin to iron hardness. Then the garage's overhead sprinkler system came on, and bitterly cold water sprayed down onto the fire.
Perenelle.
Soaked through, doubled over, and coughing, Dee wiped tears from his eyes, straightened and used both hands to douse the flames with a single movement. He called up a tiny breeze to clear the smoke, then ducked his head to peer into the blackened interior of the car, almost afraid of what he would find. The two golems that had been sitting on either side of Perenelle were now nothing more than ash. But there was no sign of the woman, except for the rent in the opposite door that looked as if it had been hacked by an axe. Dee folded to the ground with his back to the ruined car and beat both hands into the filthy mixture of mud, oil, melted plastic, and burnt rubber. He hadn't secured the entire codex, and now Perenelle had escaped. Could this day get any worse? Footsteps tip-tapped. From the corner of his eyes, Dr. John Dee watched as pointy-toed, stiletto-heeled black boots came into view. And he then knew the answer to his question. The day was about to get worse, much worse. Fixing a smile on his lips, he rose stiffly to his feet and turned to face one of the few of the Dark Elders who genuinely terrified him.
Morrigan.
The ancient Irish had called her the Crow Goddess, and she was worshipped and feared throughout the Celtic kingdoms as the goddess of death and destruction. Once there had been three sisters, Bob, Macha, and the Morrigan, but the others had disappeared over the years. Dee had his own suspicions about what had happened to them, and the Morrigan now reigned supreme. She stood taller than Dee, though most people stood taller than the doctor, and was dressed from head to foot in black leather. Her jerkin was studded with shining silver bolts, giving it the appearance of a medieval breastplate, and her leather gloves had rectangular silver studs sewn onto the back of the fingers. The gloves had no fingertips, allowing the Morrigan's long, spear-like black nails to show. She wore a heavy leather belt studded with small circular shields around her waist. Draped over her shoulders, with its full hood pulled around her face and sweeping to the ground behind her, was a cloak made entirely of raven's feathers. In the shadow of the hood, the Morrigan's face seemed even paler than usual. Her eyes were jet black, with no white showing. Even her lips were black. The tips of her overlong incisors were just visible against her lower lip.
"This is yours, I believe."
The Morrigan's voice was a harsh whisper, her voice ragged and torn, like a bird's caw. Perenelle Flamel came forward, moving slowly and carefully. Two enormous ravens were perched on her shoulders, and both held their razor-sharp beaks dangerously close to her eyes. She had barely scrambled out of the burning car, desperately weakened by her use of magic, when she'd been attacked by the birds.
"Let me see it,"
the Morrigan commanded eagerly. Dee reached into his coat and produced the metal-bound codex. Surprisingly, the Crow Goddess did not reach for it.
"Open it," she said.
Puzzled, Dee held the book in front of the Morrigan and turned the pages, handling the ancient object with obvious reverence.
"The Book of Abraham the Mage,"
she whispered, leaning forward, but not approaching the book.
"Let me see the back."
Reluctantly, Dee turned to the back of the book. When the Morrigan saw the damaged pages, she hissed with disgust.
"Sacrilege! It has survived 10,000 years without suffering any damage."
"The boy tore it,"
Dee explained, closing the codex gently.
"I'll make sure he suffers for this."
The Crow Goddess closed her eyes and cocked her head to one side, as if listening. Her black eyes glittered, and then her lips moved in a rare smile, exposing the rest of her pointed teeth.
"He will suffer soon. My children are almost upon them. they will all suffer," she promised.
Chapter 12. Josh spotted an opening between two cars, a VW Beetle and a Lexus. He pushed his foot to the floor and the heavy car shot forward, but the gap wasn't quite wide enough. The SUV's grille struck the side mirrors on the other two cars and snapped them off. "Oops!" Josh immediately took his foot off the gas.
"Keep going,"
Flamel ordered firmly. He had Sophie's phone in his hand and was talking urgently in a guttural, rasping language that sounded like nothing the twins had ever heard before. Deliberately not looking in the rearview mirror, Josh roared across the bridge, ignoring the honks and shouts behind him. He shot along the outside lane, then cut into the middle lane, then back out again. Sophie braced herself against the dashboard, peering through half-closed eyes. She saw the car hit another side mirror. It came spinning, almost slowly, up onto the hood of their SUV, scoring a long scrape in the black paint before it bounced away.
"Don't even think about it," she muttered,
as a tiny open-topped Italian sports car spotted the same gap in the traffic that Josh was aiming for. The driver, an older man with far too many gold chains around his neck, put his foot down and raced for the gap. He didn't make it. The heavy SUV caught the right front edge of the little car, just tapping it on the bumper. The sports car was flung away, spinning in a complete 360-degree turn on the crowded bridge, bouncing off four other cars in the process. Josh tore through the opening. Flamel twisted around in the seat, looking through the rear window at the chaos they had left in their wake.
"I thought you said you could drive," he murmured.
"I can drive," Josh said,
surprised that his voice sounded so calm and steady.
"I just didn't say I was good at it. Do you think anyone got our license plates?"
he asked. This was nothing like one of his driving games. The palms of his hands were slick and wet, and beads of sweat were running down the sides of his face. A muscle twitched in his right leg from the effort of keeping the accelerator pressed hard to the floor.
"I think they've got other things to worry about," Sophie whispered.
The crows had descended on the Golden Gate Bridge. Thousands of them. They came in a black wave, cawing and screaming, wings cracking and snapping. They hovered over the cars, darting low, occasionally even landing on car roofs and hoods to peck at the metal and glass. Cars crashed and sideswiped one another along the entire length of the bridge.
"They've lost focus," Skatok said, watching the bird's behavior. "They're looking for us, but they've forgotten our description. They have such tiny brains," she said dismissively.
"Something distracted their dark mistress," Nicholas Flamel said.
"Baronelle," he said delightedly. "I wonder what she did. Something dramatic, no doubt. She always did have a sense of the theatrical."
But even as he was speaking, the birds rose into the air again, and then, as one, their black eyes turned in the direction of the fleeing black SUV. This time, when they cawed, it sounded like screams of triumph.
"They're coming back," Sophie said quickly, breathlessly.
She realized that her heart was pumping hard against her ribcage. She looked at Flamel and the warrior for support, but their grim expressions gave her no comfort. Skatok looked at her and said,
"We're in trouble now."
In a huge, black-feathered mass, the crows took off after the car. Most of the traffic on the bridge was now stalled. People sat frozen in terror in their cars as the birds flowed, foul and stinking, over the roofs. The SUV was the only car moving. Josh had his foot pressed flat to the floor, and the needle on the speedometer hovered close to 80. He was becoming more comfortable with the controls. He hadn't hit anything for at least a minute. The end of the bridge was in sight. He grinned. They were going to make it. And then the huge crow landed on the hood. Sophie screamed, and Josh jerked the wheel, attempting to knock the evil-looking creature off, but it had hooked its feet into the raised ridges on the hood. It cocked its head to one side, looking first at Josh, then Sophie, and then, in two short hops, it came right up to the windshield and deliberately peered inside, black eyes glittering. It pecked at the glass, and a tiny starred puncture mark appeared.
"It shouldn't be able to do that," Josh said, trying to keep his eyes on the road.
The crow pecked again, and another hole appeared. Then there was a thump, followed by a second and a third, and three more crows landed on the roof of the car. The metal roof pinged as the birds began to peck at it.
"I hate crows," Skatok sighed.
She rooted through her bag and pulled out a set of nunchaku, 2 12-inch lengths of ornately carved wood linked by 4.5 inches of chain. She tapped the sticks in the palm of her hand.
"Pity we haven't got sunroof," she said. "I could get out there and give them a little taste of this."
Flamel pointed to where a long shaft of sunlight was coming through a pinhole in the roof.
"We may soon have. Besides," he added, "these are not normal crows. The three on the roof and the one on the hood are dire crows, the Morrigan's special pets."
The huge bird on the hood tapped the windshield again, and this time its beak actually penetrated the glass.
"I'm not sure what I can do," Skatox began, and then Sophie leaned over and hit the windshield wiper switch.
The heavy blades activated, and simply swept the bird off the hood in a flurry of feathers and a shrill croak of surprise. The red-haired warrior grinned.
"Well, there is that, of course."
Now the rest of the birds had reached the SUV. They settled on the vehicle in a great blanket. First dozens, then hundreds gathered on the roof, the hood, the doors, clutching every available opening. If one fell off or lost its grip, dozens more fought for its place. The noise inside the car was incredible as thousands of birds pecked and tapped at the metal, the glass, the doors. They tore into the rubber molding around the windows, ripped into the spare tire on the back of the SUV, tearing it to shreds. There were so many on the hood, pressed up against the windshield, that Josh couldn't see where he was going. He took his foot off the accelerator and the car immediately started to slow.
"Drive!" Flamel shouted. "If you stop, we are truly lost."
"But I can't see!"
Flamel leaned through the seats and stretched out his right hand. Sophie suddenly saw the small circular tattoo on the underside of his wrist. A cross ran through the circle, the arms of the cross extending over the edges of the circle. For a single instant, it glowed, and then the alchemist snapped his fingers. A tiny ball of hissing, sizzling flame appeared on his fingertips.
"Close your eyes," he commanded.
Without waiting to see if they obeyed, he flicked it toward the glass. Even through their closed lids, the twins could see the searing light that lit up the interior of the car.
"Now, drive," Nicholas Flamel commanded.
When the twins opened their eyes, most of the crows were gone from the hood, and those few that remained looked dazed and shocked.
"That's not going to hold them for long," Scatty said.
She looked up as a razor-sharp beak punched a hole straight through the metal roof. She snapped out the nunchaku. She held one stick in her hand, while the other, attached to the short chain, shot out with explosive force and cracked against the beak embedded in the roof. There was a startled shriek, and the beak, slightly bent, disappeared. Sophie turned her head to peer in her side mirror. It was dangling off the car, barely held on by a shred of metal and some wire. She could see more birds, thousands of them, flying in to replace those that had been swept away, and she knew then that they were not going to make it. There were simply too many of them.
"Listen," Nicholas Flamel said suddenly.
"I don't hear anything," Josh said grimly.
Sophie was just about to agree with him when she heard the sound, and she suddenly felt the hairs on her arms prickle and rise. Low and lonely, the noise hovered just at the edge of her hearing. It was like a breeze, one moment sounding soft and gentle, the next louder, almost angry. A peculiar odor wafted into the car.
"What is that smell?" Josh asked.
"Smells like spicy oranges," Sophie said, breathing deeply.
"Pomegranates," Nicholas Flamel said.
And then the wind came.
It howled across the bay, warm and exotic,
smelling of cardamom and rosewater, lime and tarragon, and then it raced along the length of the Golden Gate Bridge, plucking the birds off the struts, lifting them off the cars, pulling them out of the air. Finally, the pomegranate-scented wind reached the SUV. One moment, the car was surrounded by birds. The next, they were gone, and the car was filled with the scents of the desert, of dry air and warm sand. Sophie hit a button, and the scarred and pitted window jerked down. She craned her neck out the SUV, breathing in the richly scented air. The huge flock of birds was being pulled high into the sky, borne aloft on the breeze. When one escaped, one of the big dire crows, Sophie thought, it was quickly caught by a tendril of the warm breeze and pushed back into the rest of the flock. From underneath, the mass of birds looked like a dirty cloud, and then the cloud dispersed as the birds scattered, leaving the sky blue and clear again. Sophie looked back along the length of the bridge. The Golden Gate was completely impassable. Cars were pointed in every direction, and there had been dozens of minor accidents which blocked the lanes, and of course, effectively prevented anyone from following them, she realized. Every vehicle was spattered and splotched with white bird droppings. She looked at her brother and saw with a shock that there was a tiny smear of blood on his bottom lip. She pulled a tissue from her pocket. "You're cut," she said urgently, licking the edge of the tissue and dabbing at her twin's face. Josh pushed her hand away. "Stop. That's disgusting." He touched his lip with his little finger. "I must have bit it. I didn't even feel it." He took the tissue from his sister's hand and rubbed his chin. "It's nothing." Then he smiled quickly. "Did you see the mess the birds left back there?" Sophie nodded. He made a disgusted face. "Now that is going to smell." Sophie leaned back against the seat, relieved that her brother was fine. When she'd seen the blood, she'd been truly frightened. A thought struck her, and she turned around to look at Flamel. "Did you call up the wind?" He smiled and shook his head. "No. I've no control over the elements. That skill rests solely with the elders and a very few rare humans." Sophie looked at Scatty, but the warrior shook her head. "Beyond my very limited abilities." "But you did summon the wind," Sophie persisted. Flamel handed Sophie back her phone. "I just phoned in a request," he said, and smiled.
Chapter 13.
"Turn here," Nicholas Flamel instructed.
Josh eased his foot off the accelerator and turned the battered and scarred SUV down a long, narrow track that was barely wide enough to accommodate the car. They had spent the last 30 minutes driving north out of San Francisco, listening to the increasingly hysterical radio reports as a succession of experts gave their opinions about the bird attack on the bridge. Global warming was the most commonly cited theory, the sun's radiation interfering with the bird's natural navigation system. Flamel directed them north, toward Mill Valley and Mount Tamalpais, but they quickly left the highway and stuck to narrow two-lane roads. Traffic thinned out until there were long stretches where they were the only car in sight. Finally, on a narrow road that curved and turned with sickening complexity, he had Josh slow, almost to a crawl. He rolled down his window and peered out into a thick forest that came right up to the edge of the road. They had actually driven past the unmarked path before Flamel spotted it.
"Stop. Go back. Turn here."
Josh looked at his sister as he eased the car onto the rough, unpaved, and rutted track. Her hands were folded in her lap, but he could see that her knuckles were white with tension. Her nails, which had been neat and perfect only a few hours previously, were now rough and chewed, a sure sign of her stress. He reached over and squeezed her hand. She squeezed tightly in return. As with so much of the communication between them, there was no need for words. With their parents away so much, Sophie and Josh had learned from a very early age that they could only really depend on themselves. Moving from school to school, neighborhood to neighborhood, they often found it difficult to make and keep friends, but they knew that whatever happened, they would always have each other. On either side of the overgrown path, trees rose high into the heavens, and the undergrowth was surprisingly thick. Wild brambles and thorn bushes scraped at the side of the car, while firs, gorse, and stinging nettles, wrapped through with poison ivy, completed the impenetrable hedge.
"I've never seen anything like it," Sophie murmured. "It's just not natural."
And then she stopped, realizing what she'd just said. She swiveled around in the seat to look at Flamel.
"It's not natural, is it?"
He shook his head, suddenly looking old and tired. There were dark rings under his eyes, and the wrinkles on his forehead and around his mouth seemed deeper.
"Welcome to our world," he whispered.
"There's something moving through the undergrowth," Josh announced loudly. "Something big, I mean really big." After everything he'd seen and experienced so far today, his imagination started working overtime.
"It's keeping pace with the car."
"So long as we stay on the track, we shall be fine," Flamel said evenly.
Sophie peered into the dark forest floor. For a moment, she saw nothing. Then she realized that what she'd first taken for a patch of shadow was, in fact, a creature. It moved, and sunlight dappled its hairy hide. She caught a glimpse of a flat face, a pug nose, and huge, curling tusks.
"It's a pig, a boar," she corrected herself.
And then she spotted three more, flanking the right-hand side of the car.
"They're on my side, too," Josh said.
Four of the hulking beasts were moving through the bushes to his left. He glanced in the rearview mirror.
"And behind us."
Sophie, Scatty, and Nicholas turned in their seats to stare through the rear window at the two enormous boars that had slipped through the undergrowth and were trotting along on the path behind them. Sophie suddenly realized just how big the creatures were. Each one was easily the size of a pony. They were hugely muscled across the shoulders, and the tusks jutting up from their lower jaws were enormous, starting out as thick as her wrist before tapering to needle-sharp points.
"I didn't think there were any wild boars in America," Josh said.
"And certainly not in Mill Valley, California."
"There are wild boars and pigs all over the Americas," Flamel said absently. "They were first brought over by the Spanish in the 16th century.
Josh shifted gears, eased off the accelerator, and allowed the car to move forward at a crawl. The road had come to a dead end. The barrier of bushes, thorns, and trees now stretched across the path.
"End of the road,"
he announced, putting the car into park and setting the emergency brake. He looked left and right. The boars had also stopped moving, and he could see them, four to his side, watching. In the rearview mirror, he could see that the two larger boars had stopped too. They were boxed in.
"What now?" he wondered. "What now?"
He looked at his sister and knew she was thinking exactly the same thing. Nicholas Flamel leaned forward between the seats and looked at the barrier.
"I believe this is here to discourage the foolhardy who have traveled this far. And if one were exceptionally foolish, one might be tempted to get out of one's vehicle."
"But we are neither foolhardy nor foolish," Scatty snapped. "So, what do we do?"
She nodded at the boars.
"I haven't seen this breed in centuries. They look like Gaulish war boars, and if they are, then they are virtually impossible to kill. For every one we can see, there are probably at least three more in the shadows, and that's not counting their handlers."
"These are not Gaulish. This particular breed has no need of handlers,"
Flamel said gently, the merest hint of his French accent surfacing.
"Look at their tusks."
Sophie, Josh, and Scatty turned to look at the tusks of the huge creatures standing in the middle of the track behind them.
"They've got some sort of carvings on them,"
Sophie said, squinting in the late afternoon light.
"Curls."
"Spirals," Scatty said, a touch of wonder in her voice. She looked at Flamel.
"They are Torque Alta?"
"Indeed they are," Flamel said. "Werboars,
By werebores?
Josh said. Do you mean like werewolves? Scatty shook her head impatiently.
No, not like werewolves.
That's a relief, Josh said, because for a second there, I thought you were talking about humans who changed into wolves.
Werewolves are Torque Madra,
Scatty continued, as if she hadn't heard him.
They're a different clan altogether.
Sophie stared hard at the nearest boar. Beneath its pig-like features, she thought she could begin to see the shapes and planes of a human face, while the eyes, cool and bright, bright blue, regarded her with startling intelligence. Josh turned back to the steering wheel, gripping it tightly. Werebores. Of course they're different from werewolves. Different clan, entirely, he muttered. How silly of me.
What do we do?
Sophie asked.
We drive,
Nicholas Flamel said. Josh pointed at the barrier.
What about that?
Just drive,
the alchemist commanded.
But,
Josh began.
Do you trust me?
Flamel asked for the second time that day. The twins looked at each other, then back at Flamel, and nodded, heads bobbing in unison.
Then drive, he said gently.
Josh eased the heavy SUV into gear and released the emergency brake. The vehicle crept forward. The front bumper touched the seemingly impenetrable barrier of leaves and bushes and vanished. One moment it was there, the next it was as if the bushes had swallowed the front of the car. The SUV rolled into the bushes and trees, and for a single instant everything went dark and chill, and the air was touched with something bittersweet, like burnt sugar. And then the path appeared again, curving off to the right.
How?
Josh began.
It was an illusion,
Flamel explained.
Nothing more.
Light twisted and bent, reflecting the images of trees and bushes in a curtain of water vapor, each drop of moisture acting as a mirror. And just a little magic, he added. He pointed ahead with a graceful motion. We're still in North America, but now we've entered the domain of one of the oldest and greatest of the Elder race. We'll be safe here for a while. Scatty made a rude sound.
Oh, she's old, all right. But I'm not so sure about great.
Scatok, I want you to behave yourself, Flamel said, turning to the young-looking but ancient woman sitting beside him.
I don't like her. I don't trust her.
You've got to put aside your old feuds.
She tried to kill me, Nicholas,
Scatty protested.
She abandoned me in the underworld. It took me centuries to find my way out.
That was a little over 1,500 years ago, if I remember my mythology, Flamel reminded her.
I've got a long memory,
Scatty muttered. For an instant, she looked like a sulky child.
Who are you talking about?
Sophie demanded, and then Josh hit the brakes, bringing the heavy car to a halt.
Wouldn't be a tall woman with black skin, would it?
Josh asked. Sophie spun around to look through the cracked windshield, while Flamel and Scatty leaned forward.
That's her,
Scatty said glumly. The figure stood in the path, directly in front of the car. Tall and broad, the woman looked as if she had been carved from a solid slab of jet-black stone. The merest fuzz of white hair covered her skull like a close-fitting cap, and her features were sharp and angular, high cheekbones, straight, pointed nose, sharply defined chin, lips so thin they were almost non-existent. Her pupils were the color of butter. She was wearing a long, simple gown made of a shimmering material that moved gently in a wind that didn't seem to touch anything around her. As it shifted, rainbow colors ran down its length like oil on water. She wore no jewelry, though Sophie noticed that each of her short, blunt fingernails was painted a different color.
Doesn't look a day over 10,000 years old,
Scatty muttered.
Be nice,
Flamel reminded her.
Who is it?
Sophie asked again, staring hard at the woman. Although she looked human, there was something different, something otherworldly about her. It showed in the way she stood absolutely still, and in the arrogant tilt of her head.
This, Nicholas Flamel said, a note of genuine awe in his voice, is the elder known as Hecate. He pronounced the name slowly, Hecate.
The goddess with three faces,
Skadi added bitterly. Chapter 14. Stay in the car, Nicholas Flamel directed, opening the door and stepping outside onto the short cropped grass. Skadi folded her arms over her chest and glared out through the cracked windshield.
Fine by me.
Flamel ignored her jibe and slammed the door before she could say anything else. Taking a deep breath, he attempted to compose himself as he stepped toward the tall, elegant woman surrounded by the tall, leafless trunks of sequoia trees. The undergrowth rustled, and one of the enormous Torque Alta appeared directly in front of the alchemist, its massive head level with his chest. Flamel stopped and bowed to the creature, greeting it in a language that had not been designed for human tongues. Abruptly, the boars were everywhere, 10 of them, eyes bright and intelligent, the coarse red hair on their backs and shoulders bristling in the late afternoon light, long strings of ropey saliva dribbling from their ornately carved tusks. Flamel took care to bow to each one in turn. I did not think there were any of the Torque Alta clan left in the Americas, he said to no one in particular, dropping back into English. Hecate smiled, the merest movement of her lips.
Ah, Nicholas, you of all people should know that when we are gone, when the elder race is no more, when even the Humani have gone from this earth, then the Alta clans will reclaim it for themselves. Remember, this world belonged to the Ware clans first.
Hecate spoke in a deep, almost masculine voice, touched with an accent that had all the hissing sibilance of Greece and the liquid consonants of Persia. Nicholas bowed again. I understand that the clans are strong in Europe, the Torque Madra particularly, and I hear that there are Torque Tigger in India again, and 2 new clans of Torque Leon in Africa, all thanks to you. Hecate smiled, her teeth tiny and straight in her mouth.
The clans still worship me as a goddess. I do what I can for them.
The unseen, unfelt wind touched her robe, swirling it around her body so that it ran with green and gold threads.
But I doubt you have come all this way to talk to me about my children.
I have not. Flamel glanced back at the battered and scarred SUV. Josh and Sophie were staring intently at him, eyes wide in wonder, while Skatok's face was just visible in the back seat. She had her eyes closed and was pretending to be asleep. Flamel knew the warrior had no need of sleep.
I want to thank you for the ghost wind you sent us.
Now it was Hecate's turn to bow. Her right hand moved and opened, revealing a tiny cell phone cupped in her palm.
Such useful devices. I can remember a time when we entrusted our messages to the winds or trained birds. Seems like only yesterday, she added. I am glad the ruse was successful. Unfortunately, you have probably revealed your ultimate destination to the Morrigan and Dee. They will know who sent the ghost wind, and I am sure they are aware that I have an enclave here.
I know that, and I apologize for drawing them down on you. Hecate shrugged, a slight movement of her shoulders that sent a rainbow of light down her robe.
Dee fears me. He will bluster and posture, threaten me, possibly even try a few minor spells and incantations, but he will not move against me. Not alone. Not even with the Morrigan's assistance. He would need at least 2 or more of the Dark Elders to stand against me, and even then he would not be assured of success.
But he is arrogant, and now he has the Codex.
But not all of it, you said on the phone.
No, not all of it. Nicholas Flamel drew the 2 pages from under his T-shirt and went to hand them to Hecate. But the woman abruptly backed away, throwing up her hands to shield her eyes, a sound like hissing steam bubbling from her lips.
In an instant, the boars were around Flamel, crowding him, mouths open, tusks huge and deadly against his skin. Sophie drew breath to scream, and Josh shouted, and then Skatok was out of the SUV, an arrow notched to her bow, leveled at Hecate.
"Call them off!"
she shouted. The Torque Alta didn't even glance in her direction. Hecate deliberately turned her back on Flamel and folded her arms. Then she glanced over her shoulder at Skatok, who immediately pulled the bowstring taut.
"You think that can harm me?"
The goddess laughed.
"The arrow was dipped in the blood of a titan,"
Skatok said quietly, her voice carrying on the still air.
"One of your parents, if I remember correctly. And one of the few ways left to slay you, I do believe."
The twins watched as the elder's eyes turned cold and became, for a split second, gold mirrors, reflecting the scene before her.
"Put the pages away,"
Hecate commanded the alchemist. Flamel immediately tucked the two pages back under his t-shirt. The older woman muttered a word, and the Torque Alta stepped back from the alchemist and trotted into the undergrowth, where they immediately disappeared, though everyone knew they were still there. Hecate then turned to face Flamel again.
"They would not have harmed you without a command from me."
"I'm sure," Nicholas said shakily. He glanced down at his jeans and boots. They were covered with dribbles and strings of white Torque Alta saliva, which he was sure was going to leave a stain.
"Do not produce the codex or any portion of it in my presence, nor in the presence of any being of the elder race. We have an aversion to it,"
she said, choosing the word carefully.
"It doesn't affect me,"
Skatok said, loosening her bow.
"You are not one of the first generation of the elder race,"
Hecate reminded her.
"Like the Morrigan, you are of the next generation. But I was there when Abraham the Mage set down the first words of power in the book. I saw him trap the magic of first working, the oldest magic, in its sheets."
"I apologize," Flamel said quickly. "I did not know."
"There is no reason you should have known,"
Hecate smiled, but there was nothing humorous in it.
"That eldritch magic is so strong that most of my people cannot even bear to look upon the letters. Those who came after the original elder race, though still of our blood,"
and here she gestured toward Skatok,
"can look upon the codex, though even they cannot touch it. The ape descendants, the Humani, can. It was Abraham's ultimate joke. He married one of the first Humani, and I believe he wanted to ensure that only his children could handle the book."
"We're the ape descendants," Josh said, his voice unconsciously dropping to little more than a whisper.
"The Humani, the human race," Sophie said, then fell silent as Flamel continued talking.
"Is that why the book was given into my keeping?"
"You are not the first of the Humani to care for the Codex,"
Hecate said carefully.
"It should never have been created in the first place,"
she snapped, threads of red and green running like live wires on her robe.
"I advocated that every single page should be separated from the others and dropped into the nearest volcano, and Abraham along with it."
"Why wasn't it destroyed?" Nicholas asked.
"Because Abraham had the gift of sight. He could actually see the curling strands of time, and he prophesied that there would come a day when the Codex and all the knowledge it contained would be needed."
Skatty stepped away from the SUV and approached Flamel. She was still holding the bow loosely by her side, and she noted how Hecate's butter-colored eyes watched her closely.
"The Book of the Mage was always assigned a guardian,"
Skatok explained to Flamel.
"Some history recalls as the greatest heroes of myth, while others were less well known, like yourself, and a few remained completely anonymous."
"And if I, a human, was chosen to caretake this precious codex,
because your people cannot even look upon it, much less touch it, then it is obvious that another human must have been chosen to find it, Flamel said. D.
Hecate nodded. A dangerous enemy, Dr. John D.
Flamel nodded. He could feel the cool, dry pages against his skin beneath his t-shirt. Although he had possessed the Codex for more than half a millennium, he knew he had barely even begun to scratch the surface of its secrets. He still had no real idea just how old it was. He kept pushing the date of its creation back further and further. When the book first came to him in the 14th century, he believed it to be 500 years old. Later, when he started to do his research, he thought it might be 800 years old, then 1,000 years, then 2,000 years old. A century ago, in light of the new discoveries coming out of the tombs of Egypt, he had reassessed the age of the book at 5,000 years. And now, here was Hecate, who was 10,000 and more years old, saying she had been around when the mysterious Abraham the Mage had composed the book. But if the elder race, the gods of mythology and legend, could neither handle nor look upon the book, then what was Abraham, its creator? Was he of the elder race, a humani, or something else, one of the many other mythical races that walked the earth in those first days?
Why are you here? Hecate asked. I knew the Codex had been taken as soon as it left your presence, but I cannot help you recover it.
I've come to you for another reason, Flamel continued, stepping away from the car and lowering his voice, forcing Hecate to lean close to listen to him. When Dee attacked me, stole the book and snatched Parry, two humani came to our aid, a young man and his sister. He paused and then added, twins.
Twins?
She said, her voice as flat and expressionless as her face. Twins. Look at them. Tell me what you see. Hecate's eyes flickered toward the car.
A boy and a girl, dressed in the t-shirts and denim that are the shabby uniform of this age. That is all I see.
Look closer, Flamel said. And remember the prophecy, he added.
I know the prophecy. Do not presume to teach me my own history.
Hecate's eyes flared and, for an instant, changed color, becoming dark and ugly.
Humani? Impossible!
Striding past Flamel, she peered into the interior of the car, looking first at Sophie and then at Josh. The twins noticed simultaneously that the pupils of her eyes were long and narrow, like a cat's, and that behind the thin line of her lips, her teeth were pointed like tiny needles.
Silver and gold,
Hecate whispered abruptly, glancing at the alchemist, her accent thickening, small pointed tongue darting at her thin lips. She turned back to the twins.
Step out of the vehicle.
They looked at Flamel, and when he nodded, both climbed out. Sophie went around the car to stand next to her brother. Hecate reached out first towards Sophie, who hesitated momentarily before she stretched out her hand. The goddess took Sophie's left palm in her right hand and turned it over. Then she reached for Josh's hand. He placed his hand in hers without hesitation, trying to act nonchalant, as if stretching out to touch a 10,000-year-old goddess were something he did every day. He thought her skin felt surprisingly rough and coarse. Hecate spoke a single word in a language that predated the arrival of the earliest human civilization.
Oranges, Josh whispered, suddenly smelling and then tasting the fruit.
No, it's ice cream, Sophie said. Freshly churned vanilla ice cream.
She turned to look at her brother and discovered that he was staring at her in wonder. A silver glow had appeared around Sophie. Like a thin second skin, it hovered just above the surface of her flesh, winking in and out of existence. When she blinked, her eyes turned to flat reflective mirrors.
The glow that covered Josh was a warm golden hue. It was concentrated mainly around his head and hands, throbbing and pulsing in sync with his heartbeat. The irises of his eyes were like golden coins. But although the twins could see the glow that hovered around each other and their own bodies, they felt no different. There were only the smells in the air, oranges and vanilla ice cream. Without a word, Hecate pulled away from the twins, and immediately the glow faded. Striding back to Flamel, she caught him by the arm and moved him farther down the path, out of earshot of the twins and Scatty.
"Do you have any idea what that was all about?" Sophie asked the warrior.
There was a distinct tremble in her voice, and she could still taste vanilla ice cream in her mouth and smell it on the air.
"The goddess was checking your auras," Skatok said. "That was the golden glow around Josh?" Sophie asked, looking at her brother.
"Yours was silver," Josh said immediately.
Skatok picked up a flat pebble and tossed it into the bushes. It hit something solid, which immediately lumbered away through the undergrowth.
"Most auras are a mixture of colors. Very, very, very few people have pure colors."
"Like ours?"
Sophie asked.
"Like yours," Scatty said glumly. "Last person I knew to have a pure silver aura was the woman you know as Joan of Arc."
"What about the gold aura?" Josh said.
"Even rarer," Scatty said. "The last person I can recall having that color was..."
She frowned, remembering.
"The boy king, Tutankhamun."
"Was that why he was buried with so much gold?"
"One of the reasons,"
Skatok agreed.
"Don't tell me you knew King Tut," Josh teased.
"Never met him," Skatok said, "though I did train dear Joan and fought by her side at Orléans. I told her not to go to Paris,"
she added very softly, pain in her eyes.
"My aura is rarer than yours,"
Josh deliberately teased his sister to break the somber mood. He looked at the warrior maid.
"But what exactly does it mean to have pure colored auras?"
When Skatok turned to look at him, her face was expressionless.
"It means you have extraordinary powers. All of the great magicians and sorcerers of the past, the heroic leaders, the inspired artists, have had pure color or single color auras."
The twins looked at one another, suddenly uncertain.
This was just a little too weird, and there was something in Skatok's lack of expression that was frightening.
Sophie's eyes suddenly widened in shock.
"I just realized that both of those people, Joan of Arc and Tutankhamun, died young."
"Very young," Josh said, sobering, recalling his history.
"They both died when they were 19.
"Yes, they did, didn't they?"
Skatok agreed, turning away to look at Nicholas Flamel and the goddess with three faces.
"Shumani," Hecate snarled. "Shumani with silver and gold auras."
She sounded both puzzled and angry.
"It has happened before," Flamel said mildly.
"You think I don't know that?"
They were standing at the edge of a bubbling brook that cut through the trees and fed into an octagonal pond dappled with white water lilies. Huge red and albino koi moved through the perfectly clear water.
"I've never come across the two auras together, and never in twins. They possess enormous untapped power," Flamel said urgently. "Do I have to remind you of the Codex? The two that are one, and the one that is all. The very first prophecy Abraham speaks of."
"I know the prophecy,"
Hecate snapped, her dress now shot through with red and black veins.
"I was there when the old fool made it."
Flamel was about to ask a question, but kept his mouth shut.
"He was never wrong, either," Hecate muttered. "He knew that Danu Talis would sink beneath the waves and that our world would end."
"He also predicted it would come again," Flamel reminded her, "when the two that are one and the one that is all have arrived, when the sun and the moon are united."
Hecate tilted her head, and her slit-pupiled eyes flickered toward Josh and Sophie.
gold and silver, sun and moon.
She turned back to Flamel.
Do you believe them to be the basis of the prophecy?
Yes, he said simply. I do. I have to. Because, with the Codex now gone, Dee can begin to bring back the Dark Elders. If the twins are those mentioned in the prophecy, then, with proper training, I might be able to use them to prevent that, and to help me rescue Perry.
And if you are mistaken?
Hecate wondered aloud. Then I have lost the love of my life, and this world and all the humani on it are lost. But if we are to have any chance of success, I need your help. Hecate sighed.
It's been a long time, a very long time since I took a student.
She turned to look at Skatoch,
and that didn't turn out too well.
This is different. This time, you would be working with raw talent, pure, untainted power. And we don't have a lot of time. Flamel drew in a deep breath and spoke formally in the ancient language of the sunken island of Danu Talis. Daughter of Persis and Asteria, you are the goddess of magic and spells. I ask you to awaken the twins' magical powers.
And if I do it, what then?
Hecate demanded. Then I will teach them the five magics. Together, we will retrieve the Codex and save Perronel. The goddess with three faces laughed, the sound bitter and angry.
Have care, Nicholas Flamel, alchemist, lest you create something that will destroy us all.
Will you do it?
I will have to think upon it. I will give you my answer later.
Sitting in the car, on the other side of the clearing, Sophie and Josh suddenly became aware that Flamel and Hecate had turned to stare at them. The twins shivered simultaneously. Chapter 15.
There is something very wrong with this house. Sophie strode into her brother's room, holding her expensive cell phone up to her face. I can't get a signal anywhere.
She moved around the room, watching the screen, but the signal bar remained flat. Josh looked blankly at his sister.
Wrong with this house?
He repeated incredulously. Then he spoke very slowly.
Sophie, we're inside a tree.
I'd say there's something wrong with that, wouldn't you? When Hecate had finished speaking with Flamel, she had turned and disappeared into the woods without saying a word to them, and it had been left to Flamel to bring them to the goddess's home. Instructing them to leave the car, he led them down a narrow, winding pathway that cut through the overgrown woods. They had been so intent on the strange flora, huge, bruise-colored flowers that turned to track their movements, vines that slithered and squirmed like snakes as they followed them, grasses that had not existed since the Oligocene era, that they had failed to notice that the path had opened out and that they were facing Hecate's home. Even when they looked up, it took them several moments to make sense of what they were seeing. Directly ahead of them, in the center of a broad, gently sloping plain sprinkled with vast swaths of multicolored flowers, was a tree. It was the height and circumference of a large skyscraper. The topmost branches and leaves were wreathed in wisps of white cloud, and the roots that burst from the ground like clawing fingers were as tall as cars. The tree itself was gnarled and twisted, its bark scored and deeply etched with cracks and lines. Long vines, like huge pipes, wrapped around the tree and dangled from the branches. Hecate's home. Flamel explained. You are the only living humani in the last 2,000 years to see it. Even I've only ever read about it. Scatty smiled at the looks on the twins' faces. She nudged Josh.
Where exactly did you expect her to live? A trailer?
I don't know. I didn't think... Josh began. The sight was incredible. And from the little he had studied about biology, he knew that no living thing could grow so huge. No natural thing, he corrected himself. Sophie thought the tree looked like an ancient woman, bent over with age. It was all very well for Flamel to talk about the distant past, and a 2,000-year-old warrior or a 10,000-year-old goddess. The numbers meant almost nothing. Seeing the tree was different. Both she and Josh had seen ancient trees before. Their parents had taken them to see the 3,000-year-old giant redwoods, and they had spent a week camping with their father in the White Mountains in the north of California as he investigated the Methuselah tree, which, at nearly 5,000 years old, was supposed to be the oldest living thing on the planet. Standing before the Methuselah tree, a gnarled and twisted bristlecone pine, it was easy to accept its great age. But now, seeing Hecate's treehouse, Sophie had no doubt that it was incredibly ancient, millennia older than the Methuselah tree. They followed a smoothly polished stone path that led to the tree. As they got closer, they realized that it was more like a skyscraper than they'd first thought. There were hundreds of windows cut into the bark, with lights flickering in the rooms beyond. But it was only when they reached the main entrance that they appreciated just how vast the tree was. The smoothly polished double doors towered at least 20 feet tall, and yet they opened at the merest touch of Flamel's fingers. The twins stepped into an enormous circular foyer and stopped. The interior of the tree was hollow. From just inside the entrance, they could look straight up to where wispy clouds